It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell, in for Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, road salt is an important part of Wisconsin's winter safety, but supplies this year are low and prices are way up.
First, it's time for Food Friday. With the holidays fast approaching, a lot of people are focused on seasonal baking, and so are we here at Wisconsin Public Radio.
That's right. For the last couple of years, we've had our next guest on the show around this time of the year to share her favorite vintage holiday baking recipes.
Ruth Clark joins us now. She's a writer who blogs at MidCenturyMenu.com and NoPatternRequired.com. This year, she's been working on some vintage fast fudge recipes, and she's here to share those with us now. Ruth, welcome back to Central Time.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So every year you do a test of recipes looking for a certain treat, and this year you chose fast fudge. Now, this is a Christmas, a holiday staple in households all over the country. Why fudge?
Well, are you asking why fudge is popular? Because it's delicious. I chose fudge because I'm slowly working around, picking apart the mid-century holiday cookie plate. And so I've kind of been going through and testing each separate ingredient. Last year I did fruitcake, and the year before that it was cookies. And so this year I decided to tackle candy and specifically fudge.
And I have to ask, you know, when you think of fudge recipes, you don't always think of a lot of variations, but is there a lot of variation?
Well, I suppose there are if you consider the different flavors. I mean, most people, when they think of fudge, think of chocolate. And no, there aren't very, you know, many variations on just plain chocolate fudge. It's really delicious. But if you add a bunch of different ingredients to it, you know, you can get tons of different, like maple and peanut butter and things like that. So there are variations of fudge. And kind of the variations that I was looking at was kind of messing with the actual core ingredients to make the fudge recipe a little bit easier to make.
Right. Well, let's talk about that, because you want to have a delicious fudge that isn't too hard to make. But to your mind, what is the ideal fudge? What does it taste like?
Well, the ideal fudge is a bit crisp on the outside. I guess has a firm crust, and you bite through, and it's really creamy in the middle. That would be my ideal fudge.
And so what do you need to do to get that?
Well, the traditional fudge recipe uses sugar, butter, and milk, and boils everything up until the softball stage, which is kind of like the backbone of the fudge recipe. And then to get that creamy texture on the inside, you add the chocolate and then beat it until you have that lovely texture. And that can actually kind of be tricky if you only make it once a year, because making a good fudge actually takes some practice. So that's kind of why I was looking at ways to help people get that creamy texture that they're looking for.
And so can you do that and do it in a shortcut fashion, like a fast fudge kind of fashion?
I haven't found the ideal one yet. I'm still in the middle of testing my five recipes. I've found something that has a nice creamy texture, and I found something that's very chocolatey, but I haven't found one that kind of does both yet.
So go ahead and tell us about fast fudge. What exactly is that?
Well, I'd have to say fast fudge is kind of a shortcut method to making our favorite candy. And of course, would really be considered chocolate candies and not technically fudge, but it's just kind of recipes that use different little trick ingredients to make the process shorter. For example, the magic French fudge that I made used basically chocolate chips and sweetened condensed milk melted together, and then when they cooled, they made a really delicious chocolatey candy, and it didn't require the softball stage, and it didn't require all the beating and things like that, so.
So you called it a chocolatey candy. Does that mean you think this is somehow different than what classic fudge is?
Yeah, I think it would definitely be considered something different than what classic fudge is.
How so?
Well, I just think that really fudge really needs to have that the certain consistency, that soft consistency that I mentioned, that you can really only get by boiling something to the softball stage and then beating it, which is kind of a tricky procedure.
So I have to ask, though, is it good or is it really, really good if you make the fast fudge? That's, for me, the key as opposed to the consistency.
They're good. I mean, the fast fudge recipes that I made are good. Like I said, the magic French fudge was very chocolatey, and it was very good, and we enjoyed it. And I know my mother-in-law, after I posted the recipe, said, oh, this is the fudge recipe that I make every year. So, I mean, this is a really good candy that everybody has enjoyed. The second one I made was called Philly Fudge, which was actually chocolate chips melted and then added to cream cheese and confectioner's sugar and then allowed to set up, which didn't really make it basically made chilled frosting. It didn't really make fudge. So you kind of took a bite, you're like, yeah, this tastes like frosting. Yeah, so, you know, it wasn't quite there. So that, you know, it was very good. If you like cream cheese, it was a very good candy, but it wasn't quite fudge. The third fudge that I actually worked on had the right texture, but it didn't really have the chocolatey flavor, and that was called walnut fudge. And the ingredient that it used was actually boxed pudding mix. Mm. And it wasn't the instant pudding, but the cooked pudding. And you cooked it with a small amount of milk and butter, and then you added confectioner's sugar to that. And when it set up, it had a really good, soft texture that I was looking for. But the flavor wasn't quite there. It tasted like chocolate pudding.
So it
was chocolate pudding.
So it sounds as though your favorite was really the fast fudge.
Yeah, the magic fudge, French fudge, yeah.
Yeah. So yes. Just from a practical standpoint, the magic chocolate French fudge, how fast is it to make? Because that's important to me.
It was pretty fast. It was pretty fast to make. You just had to melt the chocolate chips and open up a can of sweetened condensed milk and mix it with the melted chocolate chips and add some vanilla, and you're basically gone.
Wow, so like 10 minutes.
I think you could make that, Gene. That sounds like a recipe Gene Purcell could make.
I could make two of those, actually.
And you could bring them in to share.
And why don't I?
quick fudge is a success.
Right, so have you brought this to holiday gatherings? Do people give it a warm welcome?
Not yet. I haven't brought it in yet. We're just still in the testing phase, so I haven't quite finished up. But when I am done, I am going to be planning on bringing it to a neighborhood Christmas party to see what everybody thinks.
Right. It's hard for anyone to get down on anything that even remotely resembles fudge, I have to say. But for people who want to try the magic chocolate French fudge, we do have that posted right now on the Central Time Facebook page. And we're going to move beyond fudge because another staple of the holidays is your classic holiday fruitcake. And you tested these. Mm-hmm. What did you find out about fruitcake?
Well, I found out that fruitcake... It's very interesting. Not a lot of people like fruitcake. I know you were asking what people's reactions were to the fudge, but last year when I would say, oh, I'm testing out fruitcake, most people's reactions were, that's gross. So that was kind of interesting. You know, you say fudge, and everyone's like, oh, that sounds great. You say fruitcake, and people are like, no thanks. You can try something else. But I really found there was one recipe that really stood out, and it was actually the classic Wesson oil recipe that they had for years and years. And I really enjoyed it when instead of using like the regular, like bright colored fruitcake fruits that they normally sell, you know the cherries and the candied pineapple and things like that. If you just use dates and raisins, and you know, or apricots, dried apricots, then it really can improve and it really makes it into a lovely holiday cake.
That sounds more traditional with your dates and your apricots than some of the sort of jewel-looking candied fruit that you see.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, dates make things moist, so that can't be bad in a fruitcake.
No, it's actually really good.
Well, we're talking right now to vintage recipe expert Ruth Clark about her favorite mid-century holiday treats.
And we're taking your calls, too. So what is your favorite old-school holiday treat? Whether it's a fruitcake or a Christmas cookie recipe that's been in your family for years. What special treats do you make every year for family and friends? Give us a call and share your recipes at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation and take your calls in a moment. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Gene Purcell. We're picking up our discussion on vintage holiday baking recipes with blogger Ruth Clark.
We're taking your calls now, too. What's your favorite vintage holiday treat? What recipe has been in your family for generations? What staples do you bake every year because you can't live without them at the holidays? And if you've got a favorite holiday baking memory, let us know about that, too. You can call in and share at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
That's right. Give us a call, 800-642-1234. And speaking of calls, we've got a listener who is with us now. And we go to Mondovi, and Jen joins us. Hi, Jen.
Hi, how are you?
I'm great. How are you doing?
I'm good. So well, I just thought I would put in a little 2 cents on that quick fudge. I actually make it every year, and I hand it out for Christmas gifts. And I love it. It's very quick and easy. I don't usually put the vanilla in it, but I mix up all the different types of chips. So I have a peanut butter, milk chocolate, a dark chocolate with walnuts, and it's just one bag of chips for one bag or one can of the condensed milk.
So is there one that's more popular than the other, or are they all pretty much the same?
Well, every year I, no matter what, make milk chocolate and peanut butter, and then I make the dark chocolate and walnuts. And then I usually do a variant with, if I come across another type of chip, then I'll add into it. But
all right. Sounds good. Jen, thanks for the call, and always know your audience, it sounds like.
We're going to go next to Debbie joining us in Menominee. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. One of the things that my family enjoys at the holiday, mostly Christmas, sometimes Thanksgiving, is my dad's family and my mom's family always like the steam pudding.
Mm.
So my mom makes this wonderful molasses cranberry steam pudding with a brandied hard sauce that goes on top of it when you're ready to eat it. And my dad's family always liked suet steam pudding, which sounds really
suet.
Awful when you think about what suet is, but it has currants in it and raisins, and you do put suet in it, but it's you know, really a great steam pudding. And again, the brandy sauce was always, you know, butter and confectioner's sugar and a little bit of brandy and vanilla is cooked up, and it's warm sauce on the warm pudding.
I'm a huge fan of steam pudding, so I'm trying to get some clarity on this suet thing, though. So is just one of the ingredients? It's a fat that's in the recipe?
Exactly.
Okay, so it's not just a steam pudding comprised entirely of suet, which was what I was first thinking. Which I thought,
I know,
well,
that's a funny thing. But no.
You learn new things every time.
Right.
Well, that
right.
Sounds fantastic. So steam pudding, right? And it takes a while. And before I let you go, Debbie, do you have a special mold for your steam pudding?
Yeah, it's one my mom has had and used for years and years. And the funny part is about it, it's not anything special. It molds the pudding, but she actually steams it in an old bottle sterilizer pan.
Wow.
You know, it's something she had for us kids, but it works great to steam the pudding in. She puts the mold inside this old bottle sterilizer, and it just works wonders.
Wow. So lots of traditions going on with steam pudding, Debbie. It sounds great. And Ruth's a steam pudding, that's a long-standing Christmas tradition. Do many people still make that? Is that one that you've tinkered with?
I actually have, not really the steam pudding part of it, but the suet pudding rang a familiar bell. We made a couple years ago a pork cake, which was baked in the oven, but it did use pork fat in it. So
that was a savory dish.
No, it was like a fruitcake.
Oh, it was a fruitcake with pork fat in it. Okay. Well, wow.
With pork fat in it. Yep, as the fat.
So it's not just unique to the suet there.
So I have to ask you this. So you were experimenting with fruitcakes last year, and I imagine as part of that you sent them out as gifts. So did any of them come back to you this year?
No one recycled them. They probably just threw them away if they didn't want them.
Well, I think that's actually a pretty good sign. You know, Ruth, you also tested out, as I understand it, some vintage Christmas cookie recipes on your blog. And what sorts of cookies did you test, and which one did you like the most?
Well, I actually tested all sorts of cookies, but I picked out three. I couldn't decide on one. The absolute favorite for me was something called a chocolate soaked snowball, which was kind of like a, you know how they had the pecan crescent cookies? It was that kind of cookie, but inside of it was a Hershey Kiss.
Ooh,
and
I like that.
And then rolled in powder. Yes, and rolled in powdered sugar. They were very, very good. And when I posted that recipe, a lot of people wrote it and said that they made those every year. And also that instead of using Hershey Kisses, they would use the bite-sized candy bars like Milky Way and Snickers, and they would put those in the middle.
I like that, too.
So that sounds really good.
As long as you can tuck candy bars in them, it's going to be a hit, I have a feeling.
Yeah, there you go. And then my husband's favorite was the frosted lemon cookies that I made, which was a lemon sugar cookie with a really delicious, like, tart lemon frosting that was on the top. So that was kind of our decision about that. And then you had mentioned fruitcake and whether or not they had come back. Well, since a lot of people don't really like, you know, fruitcake, and they look at fruitcake and they're, no, we don't want that. There's actually a cookie on the site called Annie's Cookies, which is sort of like a fruitcake cookie. So, you know, they look like a regular cookie, but then you take a bite and you get all of the spices and raisins and dates and things like that. And it was really delicious. And so kind of a way to kind of sneak fruitcake onto your cookie plate if you know people don't like it. So
get people used to the flavors before you hit them with the full thing next year. Well, it sounds delicious. You've given us a lot of inspiration here. And finally, is there one last cookie you're hoping to make this season?
Oh, I'm hoping to just make brownies. Is that silly? I like to make some brownies with mint frosting.
Well, I never think brownies are silly. Simple, classic, delicious.
And mint frosting
as
a bonus.
Frosting.
I'm drooling over here on this side of the
studio. Gene and I are sold. Well, Ruth, I wish you a tasty holiday season. Happy baking.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Ruth Clark, a writer who blogs at MidCenturyModernMenu.com and NoPatternRequired.com. She was with us to talk about vintage baking recipes.
And right now we are here to talk to you for just a few moments about road salt.
That's right. Road salt may be as common as snow during Wisconsin winters, but this year some of it's coming all the way from Morocco since stockpiles are low and it's been hard to come by.
And remember, you can support conversations like this with your pledge to Wisconsin Public Radio. It's part of our winter membership drive, and you can give us a call or make a pledge online. Here's how you do it online. It's WPR.org. or 888-202-2552.
That's right. It's the end of the year. Time to think back over all of that wonderful listening you did here at Wisconsin Public Radio in 2014, the stories that stuck to you, that kept you thinking, that made you laugh. What is that worth to you? Put a pledge number on it and then make that pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And thank you so much for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Gene Purcell.
And I'm Veronica Rickert.
Imagine with me for just a moment. It's mid-January, not too far away. A winter storm is set to hit Wisconsin within hours, and everybody is inside. They're all hunkered down, listening to the news with a warm drink. But other people are outside right now, and they are hard at work, and they are in those salt trucks. They're covering the road and parking lots with salt, trying to make them as safe as possible once the snow comes.
Road salt may seem like a standard part of Wisconsin winter safety, but this year, it's a lot harder to come by. Thanks to last year's epic winter, this year's salt is coming from all over the world to the Port of Milwaukee for winter use, and prices are almost doubled. Here with us now is Milwaukee Journal business reporter Rick Rommel. Rick, thanks for being with us.
You bet. Glad to be here.
Well, how much more expensive is salt this year compared with last year?
Well, it is more than double. For the private contractors, it is as much as triple. I think last year they were paying around $60, $65 a ton. And this year it's $150 to $200 a ton.
So that's a huge jump. Why? Why is salt up so much?
It's totally a supply demand situation. What happened is last year, you know, as you know, we had a very hard winter. There was a lot of salt used. Supplies got drained really, really low last winter, to the point where in some places there was none left, and some of these private guys were spreading sand on parking lots instead of salt. So there's only so much production capacity in the regions that supply the upper Midwest. They weren't able to build the stocks back up as high as they usually are. So these private guys were forced to pay premium prices by going overseas for salt to Morocco, Egypt, Venezuela.
That's pretty far afield. Where do we normally get our salt?
There are these incredible salt mines in the eastern part of the Great Lakes region in southern Ontario, Ohio, New York, I think Pennsylvania. One of the largest ones, in fact, it's supposed to be the largest salt mine in the world, is in Goderich, Ontario. It's on the eastern shore of Lake Huron, and something like 25% of the salt that goes to the Milwaukee area comes out of that mine. There's also a mine underneath the city of Detroit, believe it or not.
Ah, wow. So you would just nip over to Detroit or Ontario normally, but this year people are getting their salt from, you said, Egypt and Morocco?
Egypt and Morocco, yeah. Now, this is not true of the municipal and the governmental entities. You know, they're getting their salt from the usual supplies. They have multi-year contracts with the big salt companies, and there are three of them. There's Morton, Cargill, and a company called Compass. And so the municipalities are in good shape, and their prices are stable. City of Milwaukee, I think, is paying something like $56 a ton this year because they negotiated the contract in the past, and so they have plenty. But these private guys, they're being squeezed out. So one company went to this salt mine in Morocco where they have this brown salt that's supposed to be very good. Another one went to Egypt, and they're getting salt that's not mined, but it's made from evaporating seawater.
Oh, so then how do we get this salt from Morocco here to Milwaukee or Wisconsin?
Big ships. The one that came from Morocco carried 25 or 26,000 tons on it. The one from Egypt had something like 15,000 tons and 20-some thousand tons from Venezuela. So they're coming through the St. Lawrence Seaway.
It's so interesting how international this has gotten. I think I read that one of these shipments of salt, maybe the one from Morocco, came in on a Jamaican ship. So this salt has been all over.
Right. Yeah, indeed. Yes.
So is the idea that normally there would be some salt left over? It wouldn't be a crisis right away. But last winter, it just hit us too hard.
Right. Correct. There were one of the private contractors in Milwaukee told me that typically, and these are people who do large scale commercial work, shopping centers, factory parking lots, big box stores, that kind of thing. So they will go out, like maybe they expect to go out 30 times a year over the course, or 30 times a season, I should say. Last year it was 51. So, you know, close to double. By the time they got to the end of the winter, as I mentioned, some of the contractors had no more salt left, or they had very little. They started mixing it with sand, which is, you know, has a lot of benefits, really. It's environmentally, it's a lot more friendly to use than salt. But when you're talking about a shopping center parking lot or a store, those folks, the people who own those places, they don't like it because it tracks in dirt and grit and dust and stuff into their buildings. And that's what folks were left to do last year.
In terms of these rates, which are double and triple at some points, who's getting hit with that price tag the hardest?
Right. Well, I'm not exactly sure. I think you can be pretty confident that the consumers, who in this case would be the people who own the shopping center or the Kmart store or whatever, they're the ones who will pay. Their prices are going up. For right now, it's the commercial contractors that are, for the moment, they are absorbing the hit. But expect them to pass that entirely or in large part along to their customers.
So are you saying that we might be shopping, the consumer, and that the prices inside the store are going up too, maybe?
Well, that's a stretch. I don't think that would happen. This is, you know, it's a big price increase for the people who are buying it and the buying salt and the people who are in this business. But when you spread that out, the cost of salting up the parking lot at, say, the Mayfair Shopping Center in Milwaukee, it's a minuscule. The cost to Mayfair is a minuscule part of its overall operating expenses. So, no way it would increase prices for, you know, sweaters and shoes and stuff that you buy at the mall.
Well, so last year we heard about some cities experimenting with alternatives to salt, things like cheese brine, which apparently smells a little stinky but is pretty effective.
Really?
Do you see that as being something people turn increasingly toward if salt prices keep going up?
I think so. In the city of Milwaukee, they have made, because they ran the city proper now, not private contractors, but the city clearing the streets, They ran so low last winter that toward the end of the winter they were putting sand down on side streets. Well, this winter they're doing that from the get-go. So their policy is that they will put a mixture of sand and salt on side streets. We'll put salt on the arterials to keep them as clear as possible for safety reasons. And then another thing that the city of Milwaukee is doing is you're working with brine, but it's a salt brine, not a cheese brine. And it's basically, I don't know a lot about this, but I guess they wet the salt down, the rock salt down, and it turns into this sort of slurry or slush, this briny mixture. And supposedly that goes further than just the dry salt crystals themselves. And supposedly it sticks to the pavement better, so it would be more effective. I wasn't really writing about what the cities were doing, so I didn't press for more detail on that. But to me, I would wonder, if that's the case, why don't you always do that? Why are you only doing it now that that there's this shortage going on?
Well, I suppose these higher prices aren't welcome news to these contractors or these stores that are using this salt. But, you know, in a way, do you think there's something kind of cool about having salt on our streets from Morocco and Egypt?
Oh yeah. When we first heard about on Monday about this ship coming into the port of Milwaukee from Egypt, you know, at first I just thought it's a curiosity, but an interesting one. I mean, how often you just don't expect to be getting a low value commodity like salt shipped halfway around the world. It certainly speaks to the globalization of commerce. You know, the United, one of the big exports of the United States to China is scrap metal. So all this, you know, all these scrap cars that get crushed into blocks of metal, a lot of that stuff gets shipped over to China, and they use it, they melt it down and use the steel and other metals for to produce new pots and pans and all the other stuff that they ship to us.
Well, it's quite a story. Rick, thank you for coming on and telling us about it today.
Well, you bet. It was fun. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. We've been speaking with Rick Rimmel of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel about road salt shortages and skyrocketing prices.